evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. At this time, we begin the second act, as we've done for the last 35 years, starting in 1982. This will be TechNet number 1693. You'll also be seeing Space Report from WS2N Paul number 293. We'll be getting Science and Physics Report number 23 from Roy, AC2GS. We've got quite a number of subjects to talk about tonight. The universe they discovered that doesn't have dark matter in it. The James Webb Space Telescope being further delayed. The Chinese space station that's going to come down within a few hours of now. And the lightning article that was in the Parade Sunday issue of Newsday. Let me drop. Those are some of the subjects we'll be discussing tonight. The TechNet gathers people who are curious and want to know more about radio and science, and they gather here and teach each other. I made some errors last week, which I'm going to be correcting with reference to a loop antenna, which is a somewhat rarely used antenna. I made some pronouncements that were definitely wrong. I expected to be getting some flack mail on that. I didn't, but I know I made a mistake, and the fact that I didn't hear mail from people on the subject tells me that very few of us are really familiar with loop antennas and what they can do and the way they really behave when you orient them in different ways. Let me drop. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment by giving us his call letters, his name. Try to remember to give me your name. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in because you're listening. After 35 years of TechNet, 6,000 hours worth, we know somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. You can listen to the last 12 years of TechNet by going to Mike number one's website, KC2NJI, amateurradio.tangovictor. No WW in front of it. Amateurradio.tangovictor. And some additional information from website number two is at technetlimark.com, where you'll find additional information supporting this particular TechNet. Let me drop. Try to remember to wait for the four beeps in between, otherwise you might get timed out. So at this time, we're going to take check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. So give me your call letters and name right now after the four beeps. K2LAW listening.
K2GES. Name is Bob.
Okay, Bob, I think you better give that to me phonetically. It sounded like Alpha Alpha 2 Golf Echo Foxtrot. Is that your call letters, Bob? Go ahead.
Negative. It's Kilo Alpha 2 Golf Echo Foxtrot.
Okay, Kilo Alpha 2 Golf Echo Foxtrot. And you could use a little bit more audio. I bet you sound pretty good. All right, we got Bob. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment. Wait for the four beeps and give me your call letters and your name.
WS2N Paul. Good evening, Dick. And I wanted to make an announcement about the space station. I heard you already did that, so I don't know if you want to cover that.
Paul, after we take check-ins, I'm going to turn it over to you to tell us the latest in what we know as to what, when, and where that the Chinese space station is going to come down. It's about to enter the atmosphere and burn up, and some of the material from that multiple thousand pounds of satellite is probably going to survive the re-entry and strike most likely water, but who knows where it's going to strike. We'll soon find out. As I said, I'll be turning it over to you. Anyone else to check in? We've got Bob so far. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2RIY Joe, yes, question for the space report portion of the net.
Okay, we got you, Joe. So far we got Bob and Joe. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and your name right now.
KD2PKAJ.
J, that sounded like Kilo Delta 2, Papa Kilo Alpha. Do I have the correct J? Go ahead.
It's correct.
Very fine, we got J. One last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet because you do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters right now and your name. We've got more than enough to start. Paul, tell us what we know about when is it likely. I think the prediction is that sometime after midnight tonight is the best prediction as to when the Chinese space station is likely to enter the atmosphere. And I think it's been up there since something like 2011. So tell us what we know about it and what its reentry is likely to be like. WS2N, Paul, with the early version of the space report, K2RIW and the TechNet. You've got a call.
Okay, Tiangong 1 is the Chinese first space station that they put up there quite a few years ago. About, I think it's been up there at least 8 years now. And they had three different crews visit it, and in that time they abandoned it, and what happened is they eventually lost control of it. They have no way to fire the thrusters or have a controlled reentry. So that's going to come down, like you said, anywhere, probably in the water, because the Earth is mostly water. But since the furthest inclination that they go is, what, just over 42 degrees. I think it's 42.27 degrees. Let's call it 43 degrees. Inclination, that means either 43 north or 43 south of the equator. That's the area you can come down in. You know, so you go in northern Montana or Canada or something, you're okay. Well, in the Antarctic, no problem. Anywhere in that area, let me drop it. There are some parts, some pieces that they expect to make it all the way down. It's heavy. It's nowhere near the weight of the Skylab that came down in 1973, I think. That was about 10 times heavier. This thing's like 17,000 pounds. Skylab was like 170,000 plus. So, you know, one-tenth the weight and one-tenth the size. But still, it's a lot of weight if it comes down in a populated area. So last time I checked a couple of the websites, it's still up there, and maybe as early as 3 hours from now, so maybe during the net, you know, we might get a report that it's finally re-entered the atmosphere. Now, this type of thing has happened before with Skylab and a lot of other spacecraft that come down that are not controlled, but this happens to be quite large, so it's some kind of concern. They do now have a second space station that's up there, Tiangong 2. And that's still operational. In fact, they plan on eventually sending possibly another crew up there. Maybe. That's even in doubt. They did send a crew up. Since then, they've sent up the equivalent of a Progress ship. They wanted to see if they could send a craft up to dock with Tiangong 2 and see if they could refuel it. So they've done that successfully, and that one is just still in control. So my guess is, you know, when it comes time to re-enter with that one, they'll have some kind of control, and it will probably burn up over the Pacific Ocean, like most of the spacecraft that go up. All those cargo vehicles, except for Dragon, that go up the International Space Station, burn up in the same fashion they burn it up over the Pacific Ocean. When the Mir spacecraft came down, which was about one-fifth the size of the International Space Station, they planned on that entering over the Pacific, and that was successful as well. Skylab, that was out of control, and it just happened to come down in the Indian Ocean and parts of it hit land in Australia. I think it injured a cow or something, but that's the story on that. We'll keep a watch on it. We'll let you know what happens later on tonight. Back to you, Dick, WS.
There's a website called Heavens Above, which allows you to track many of the pieces of hardware in space and tells you where to look and when to look in order to see it up in the sky. And I believe this Chinese space station was viewable this morning at something like 5:30 in the morning this morning. Assuming that it comes down a little bit later, because since we're at the low part of the sunspot cycle, the atmosphere is not as puffy as usual, therefore not quite as much atmospheric drag is occurring, and quite possibly the Chinese Tiangong will survive beyond the anticipation of the next few hours, and so it might still be there tomorrow morning. To your knowledge, Paul, has Heavens Above made a prediction as to whether or not we can see it again at somewhere like 5 a.m. Tomorrow morning? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I just go to Heavens Above, so I don't know. Just checked a couple of the other ESA, you know, there's a European Space Agency website that was following it, and there was another one, I forget the name of that one, but you know, there's quite a few of them that are following it, and maybe they're getting the information from the same place. You know, NORAD follows all of these things in detail, you know, down to 10 centimeters or smaller. So they're probably all getting their information from the same location, I would think. So, don't know. I didn't hear that it was visible this morning, so that's new to me. The last I saw it, this thing came out about an hour ago. Was they predicted about 3 hours from now. Back to you, Jerry.
Yeah, what Heavens Above was predicting, according to Newsday, was that this morning at around 5:30, because it was up high and being hit by sunlight, even though we're still down here in the dark, you see this bright object drifting across the sky, and you could therefore see, you could sight it tomorrow from central Long Island and probably quite a few other places. And so if it lasts long enough, and if you go to Heavens Above and tell Heavens Above where you live, quite possibly it'll tell you what hour to look in what direction in order to see it, if it's still up there.
That's way, PG.
Go right ahead, N2APG, K2RIW. Sounds like you already checked.
Yeah, I couldn't resist. I was on the computer anyway. It's the Tiangong, it's the number one satellite. Is that the one we're talking about?
That's the one, Dave. Go ahead.
Okay, there's no prediction for it on the Heavens Above website, so I assume that they're believing it's going to be down before, there's no prediction listed for it.
Well, there's two possible interpretations of that, Dave. Number one, they think it's going to be down, or number two, for your and my location in Long Island, the satellite really is moving in a constant planar path with reference to inertial coordinates, and the Earth is rotating under it. Since the satellite comes back every 90 minutes, that means every 22 degrees of rotation of the Earth is when it comes back. So quite possibly the pass tomorrow morning, if it's still up there, will be either too far east of us or too far west of us. So it may not be within our sight tomorrow morning at sunrise. You need a coincidence of sunrise for the satellite, but not bright sun for us, and still being within range of our horizon. So that's another possible explanation. See where I'm going on that one, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's possible. But like I said, there's no prediction for it. The other Tiangong, the number two satellite, there's numerous predictions for that one. It doesn't seem to be too terribly bright. It goes from magnitude, anywhere from a one magnitude up to about a four magnitude. So not that bright, you know, in this poor viewing area. So I just wanted to throw that in there. I'll go back to listening, and back to you, Dick, N2APG.
AC2CF.
Okay. just hear from?
AC2GS.
Go right ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I think it's rather amusing. I'm reading Sputnik News, of all things. They're predicting that it's going to drop out of the sky in about 20 minutes and land somewhere on the East Coast or beyond of South America.
And WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I am having this above, you know, I have the app, and it shows it right now. It's halfway between Australia and South America, coming up on Argentina in about 15 minutes, and then heading up toward Africa, and eventually toward China. So, you know, it'll go as far as 43 degrees north, because that's where it would launch from China. But there's nothing else with that. I mean, they're showing the period is 87 minutes, so 87 and a half minutes. So that's a little less than normal. Usually it's 90, 92 or something like that. So it must be slowing down. Showing a height of 139 kilometers. It's got a perigee at 127, so that's getting lower. And the inclination right now is as far south as it could go, 42.7 degrees right now. Back to there.
And you said what most people will say, Paul, it's slowing down. When a satellite is being hit by the atmosphere and it's experiencing atmosphere drag, that causes it to go into a lower orbit. The lower orbit, which is normally for a low Earth orbit satellite, 90 minutes, become in this case, I think it's at 87 minutes. So the shorter orbit really means it's moving faster. The craziness of atmosphere drag is at first, the atmosphere drag makes the satellite go to a lower orbit and a faster speed. It is trading off potential energy at altitude into kinetic energy or velocity. So it's actually moving faster. And the fact that it's come down is showing that it's getting atmospheric drag. I know you're not a betting man, Bob, but I'm going to ask both you and Roy, if you were going to place a bet, when do you think it's going to come down? A half hour from now? 2 hours from now? What's your first guess, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW, and the TechNet?
I'm going with tomorrow morning. You know, it does take a lot of drag. You know, I mean, it's hitting atmosphere up there, but it's very opaque. It's, you know, the molecules are very far apart, so it's going to take some time to, you know, slow it down if it's going that fast. Yeah, so I'm gonna say tomorrow morning, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, something like that. That's my guess.
And Roy, you're more of a scientist than a betting man, but if you were going to place a bet, what's your guess, Roy, as to when the Chinese space station might re-enter the atmosphere? AC2GS, K2LAW, and TechNet?
Well, I mean, most reports that I've heard put it at less than an hour, so I'd say an hour or less.
How about that? So before we end the TechNet tonight, we may be hearing about it. See, there's another comment I was going to ask you about, Paul. Oh, yes. The Chang'an 1 or 2, I think you said, has got not a super bright object, magnitude 1 to magnitude 4. Whereas the Iridium satellites, when you get a flash from one of those, I think they go to numbers like minus 3 and minus 4, very bright. And when it comes to the International Space Station, what's the brightest you've ever seen that? So tell me, from your memory, Paul, roughly how bright is the flash that we get from the International Space Station, any of the Tongangs, versus the Iridium satellites? WS2N, K2LAW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, I've never witnessed the flashes from the Iridium satellites. You know, I see them listed here all the time, but I've never gone through the trouble waiting for one to go by. Naturally, you need a clear night for it. So I'm not sure what the magnitude is on that. On the space station, though, you know, that's all I've seen. It was like minus 3.6. and once in a blue moon, you're going to get a three. Back to you, Dick.
For those who are listening, what we're discussing right now is when you go to Heavens Above, that website, and you tell it your approximate address by either latitude and longitude or the name of the town you're in, they'll tell you what space objects you can see, when and what direction to look, how many degrees above the horizon, and do you look north, south, east, and west. So Heavens Above gives you those kind of predictions, and they tell you how much brightness you're going to get. And when it comes to magnitude, the more negative the number, the brighter it is. And so Dave into APG has quite often told me about these predictions by Heavens Above. And one particular night, he told me about an iridium flash that he's going to get, and I think it was one of these at -3, -4. And in Huntington, where I live, that particular night, it was completely overcast. But I said, what the heck? Because it's going to be so bright, I went in to a place where I could see the sky. I looked in that particular direction, and they told you exactly how many minutes after what hour is going to be the flash. So through the thick cloud cover that was there, complete overcast, I looked in that direction, and I saw the flash through the clouds. So their prediction is pretty darn good once they know your location. Let's see if Dave knows of anything else along these lines that we should be taking a look for from Heavens Above. Into APG, if you're there, Dave. KQRI, W in the TechNet.
Into APG. Well, the iridium flares are, in my opinion, one of the best things you can watch because those are really spectacular. They do get as bright as -8 magnitude, -8, which is just about blinding. So those are great. Also, the Heavens Above website, they have a couple of new features. They have an interactive star chart, you know, which gives you all the stars and constellations in the sky. And it's a great website, very user-friendly. And if you're not familiar with it, I would recommend you go check it out. You log in, you put your location, your viewing location, so that the information that you're going to get is specifically tailored exactly for where you're located. And the predictions are just about right on the money to the second as far as the iridium flares. Absolutely right on the second. I would say that in the number of years that I've been watching the iridium flare satellites, 99.5% of the predictions are absolutely right on the money. Occasionally, there'll be a prediction and the satellite, for whatever reason, doesn't appear. But so that could be, you know, something's happened to the satellite or something to that effect. But almost always, the prediction is perfect.
I am guessing that the phased array on the iridium satellites has a very flat reflective surface somewhere in the satellite. And when the sun shines off that reflective surface, it's sort of like the sun shining onto a mirror. And that mirror gives you a spot on the ground that's only a couple of towns wide. I've seen some of the Heavens Above predictions where Dave in Massapequa are supposed to get his flash at a particular time, and me in Huntington, a few miles away, supposed to get my flash at a slightly different time. So it's like using a heliostat, a mirror flashing the sunlight onto the ground. So Heavens Above has to know what town you're in order to predict for you when that flash is going to occur. One other question I've got for you, Paul. You keep your ear to the ground with reference to all of the space websites, NASA in particular. If a person listening to us tonight wants to know the latest information as to when the Chinese space station enters the atmosphere, what website would you recommend they go to so they get the latest information as to when it really does re-enter? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I'd have to go back to the European Space Agency website. They had a good one. I don't have it in front of me right now. That up again. But if you put in, the news reports will probably be current. Heavens Above shows the location of the satellite. So, you know, you click on orbit when you're on that website, and it'll show you a map of the Earth and where that satellite is located. Like I said, right now it's coming up on Argentina. So if I go back, let's say 2 hours from now, and I click on that, it's gone from... it's gone up. I'll say, well, Roy was right. It went down an hour from now. Back to you, Dick.
To UPS.
Mr. UPS, go right ahead. Sounds like Rich. The signal was a little bit noisy, but you sound good. You got it, Rich.
UPS, I'm on an HD in the house, Dick. Good evening to you and the rest of the net. I just want to say a better way, I think, that even using Heavens Above is one of the many apps that are available on both Android and Apple phones. There are several really good ones out for both platforms, and it uses your GPS coordinates, so you don't even have to put in where you are. It knows where you are, and it adjusts as you move around to your location. And all of the mapping, everything, you can have it beep right before it's supposed to come, you know, appear, everything. I think having the cell phone in your hand outside is better than looking it up on a computer than running outside myself. Back to you.
I agree, Dick, but I don't, you know, some people, I don't have the GPS, so, yeah, he's right, if you got a good phone.
Paul, do you predict that Heavens Above, which will tell you where it is right now, do you think they will be as current as that if it suddenly enters the atmosphere and disappears, do you think Heavens Above will know about it in a very short period of time? What's your guess on that one, Paul?
Yeah, it's not like a guy sitting there putting all this information, you know, they're getting all the Keplerian elements all properly from NOAA on all these, I mean, NORAD. So they're probably getting all that information. And that all automatically going into their computer. They do not have Keplerian elements. And they've updated probably, you know, very frequently. They're not going to see a satellite when that thing is gone. That's what I think. You know, on Heavens Above or any of the websites, they all get their tracking information from the same place. It's not like you have another separate tracking group somewhere. Although European Space Agency does. But back to the
APG with comments.
You got serious.
Yeah, as long as we're talking about the Iridium satellite. 2 days ago, they just launched 10 more Iridium satellites into orbit. So they're going to be more Iridiums up there. So the chances of seeing a nice bright satellite has increased, I think, by 10 more. So that's pretty cool.
They're small. They're different.
Oh, they are? Okay.
Yeah, SpaceX, I think it is. Elon Musk did another very successful launch of 10 separate satellites. Is that true, Paul? Give us some words on that one. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, they were successful. Man. You know, the fifth launch of the 10 at a time. But, you know, I like to find out. There's a whole bunch of satellites up there. I think there's 40. This is, you know, 10 more. But I haven't heard of any Iridium flares coming off the newer satellites that are up there. And they're already in position. But, you know, I mean, it's possible. I was wondering about that myself. Maybe there is going to be an Iridium flare, and, you know, it's just going to be smaller or something. But I don't know. I think that's changed. These are much smaller satellites than the older ones. Yeah, it was very successful. And, you know, they decided not to recover the booster on purpose because it was already used before. They tried to recover the bearing, but the bearing got tangled in the parafoil, so they weren't able to save the bearing. So next time they launch from Vandenberg, California, they'll try that again. But yeah, overall they had, as far as launch is concerned, 100%. And I believe they have one more launch to go.
It could be that Heavens Above is not tracking the 10 new ones yet, because it takes a while to do a careful measurement of the so-called Keplerian elements, those six numbers, to tell you where it is in space, its altitude, its inclination, its velocity, its semi-major axis, its right ascension of the ascending nodes, its epoch time. When you get those six numbers, and by doing some ground tracking very accurately, you eventually find out exactly what those six numbers are, and that allows you to make predictions. So those 10 new satellites, they may not have the exact numbers yet, for, let's say, heavens above. And I'm going to make a guess that's why the flashes of those 10 new Iridium satellites, maybe that's why we're not seeing those. That's a guess. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I got info.
Go ahead, Dave.
Take his info. I don't know. I didn't know they were. I don't think they were operational yet, so take the other info.
You got it, Dave.
And to APG again, I suspect that the new Iridium satellites are going to be visible, because when I just looked at the heavens above prediction, and they give you the satellite number along with the prediction, and I've never seen an Iridium satellite with a number as high as 94, and that's one of the satellites that's being predicted, 94. Before that, you know, they were in the 60s and maybe 70s. But there's a number 94 that's up there, so I would think that's one of the new ones.
I believe Iridium is something like number 77 on the periodic table, and that's where the name of those satellites come from. The originally were proposing 77 satellites. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yes, that's how it all started. So they were going to use the atomic number. But then they decided, well, we really only need 66, not 77. So what do? We just spent, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on building these things. Are we going to change the name? Nope, let's leave it that way. And they left it that way. And then they had some backup satellites, and they put them up just in case the other ones fail. So it kind of got close to 77. And the same is going to hold true for all of these. They have like 50, and I think there's 8 more to go. And then on that last flight, there's 2 spots open, and they're going to launch 2 completely different satellites that have nothing to do with Iridium, just to fill up the space. And they're called GRACE. They're scientific satellites, actually, for NASA. So I believe 8 more to go. And they have some backups in the garage. That's the way they put it. Eventually, they might put them up in the future. Just in case something fails, they'll be able to utilize different satellites. So that's it. I mean, you know, they're more improved, much better than the older ones. The older ones are still functioning. So I guess when they have all of these up, they'll all become operational. I think they need a lot of them up to make them fully operational before you start charging customers. Otherwise, you're going to have dead spots, and, you know, and you don't need those kind of complaints from the customers.
For those who have just joined us, we're discussing the Chinese space station, Tiangong 1, which is due to enter the atmosphere. It's quite a few tons of hardware, as big as a school bus. It's going to enter the atmosphere in the next few hours. So that's the discussion we're having right now, and which websites to go to find out when it really happens, and whether or not some of the hardware is going to land in the water or over land, and will it survive the reentry. Some of the heavy pieces of metal are predicted to enter the atmosphere, survive, and strike Earth in the water or the land somewhere. Anybody with any further questions or comments before we leave this subject, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. Later on, we'll be discussing a little bit more of this during the space report. We'll be discussing dark matter. They just discovered a galaxy that seems to have no dark matter. They used to think every one of them had dark matter. And some information on the zigzag of lightning. Why does it do that? There was an article in Newsday's Parade magazine this Sunday, today, which has what I think is an error in that subject. Okay, we're now going to go back to what we usually start off with, and that is people who signed in who do have a question or a comment. Bob was our first person, KA2 Golf Echo Foxtrot. You've got it, Bob, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, I changed and went on Echo Link because you said my audio was low on my HT. All right, here's my question. First of all, I have a, we spoke to you about it. I spoke to you about it last week. A five-element VHF beam. It has a, balum wire. And in it, it says just tape along and in three positions, the loop that comes out. Tape it in three places. It's about 19 inches, right? And let me drop it. Okay. And it turns out that every picture says, just let it hang. I've never had an antenna with a balum before, a beam. They all had matches or they were commercial. So they always had a cable coming out, and that was it. And nothing else. Doesn't matter if I P-tie it from keeping it from getting ice and snow and just hanging there to the boom, or just let it hang there. Back to you, Dick. K2GEF.
Bob, the device you're talking about called Balun, which stands for balanced to unbalanced, B-A-L-U-N, N for Nancy, not M for Mike, N for Nancy. Quite a few people pronounce it with the M. They come in many forms. Some of them are coax in and coax out. Some of them are coax in and the twin lead out. And the only part that's a little bit sensitive is the twin lead coming out. If the twin lead coming out is laying flat against metal, it'll change the impedance a little bit and it could disturb things. But as far as the rest of it's concerned, the way usual balans are constructed, you can weatherproof it if you want to, put plastic bags over it, tie it down any way you want. So, as I said, the only thing that I think is somewhat sensitive is the so-called twin leads coming out, if that's the kind of balun it is. Over to you, Bob, for some further information. KA2GEF, K2RIW in the tech net.
No, it's not a twin lead, Dick. It's just, it looks like RG58 looped, and the ends go to a beta, they call it a beta match. One side's the negative side, one side's the positive side. And in the middle, you connect the two negatives of the shield, and that goes to the boom. And from what the instructions tell me, it's a 200 ohm impedance on the antenna. Without it, with it, it makes it 50 ohms. That's it.
Okay, there's a kind of so-called half-wave coax balun, which gives you a 4-to-1 impedance ratio. 50 ohms in, 200 ohms out. That particular kind, the actual loop of the U-shaped loop of wire, wiring-wise, is a half wavelength long electronically, and you can coil that up if you want to and tie it together with tie wraps or tape and so on, and you could tape that against the boom if you wanted to. So it doesn't have to hang in the air. People think it does. It's not very sensitive because the signal is flowing down the center conductors of that coax cable. The shield on that thing is absolutely cold. So the fact that you've wrapped multiple turns, taped it or tie wrapped it, and held it up against the boom or the mast for good support, you've got the complete freedom to do that, and it's not at all sensitive. That's a very insensitive, very broadband, very high performance kind of balun, if that's the one we're talking about. Over to you, Bob, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you. That's exactly it. That's all it is. All right, so I'm going to P-tie, because all my antennas, I've always P-tied them to the mast when I used to do commercial antennas. P-tie it, because they always show it in the air. And a nice sunny day, the picture of the antenna with the wire just hanging there. But I live in a place where it snows, it gets icy, it's windy. I don't want it, I'm not going to take it down in the wintertime, so I just want it to last. And that's it. So I'm going to just P-tie it to the boom and take it where they said And that's it. I appreciate the information. And I'm just waiting to get one of those Chinese radios that dropped down from the sky tonight. No, only kidding. Take care, Dick. KA2GES. We'll be clear. Thank you.
KP2GS.
Roy recognized that halfway correct. That one is very insensitive. And I'm with you, Bob. I wouldn't want it to hang in the air. We're waving back and forth in the breeze. You're going to get metal fatigue. The only thing you've got to worry about a little bit with that thing is you may have to do some weatherproofing of the ends of the coax cable. You don't want water going down that coax cable. You wouldn't have to worry about that very much if you made it out of solid polyethylene-type coax. But if you use something like foam coax, try to do some weatherproofing at the end. AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy.
I must regretfully announce to people that Celestial Palace 1 is no more. May it rest in peace.
Okay. The thing that rest in peace, you gave it a name I didn't recognize. Are you saying the Chinese space station has entered the atmosphere? Is that what you're telling us, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes, the translation for Tangong is Celestial Palace, so it's Celestial Palace 1. And according to the report that I'm reading, it entered, it burned up, it's gone. They can't give you an exact location of where it just kind of burnt up, and they might find little fragments in the ocean, they may not, who knows. But as far as the report that I'm reading, it's gone.
Fantastic. I had you give a prediction earlier, and you said it's going to be within the hour. You were right on the money. Where did you get your information from, Roy? How did you hit it so close? And you ought to go to a casino also. You got it, Roy.
Well, it was a bet. I was expecting someone to pay me off here. But no, seriously, I just did a couple of searches, and everyone and their brother was saying 20 minutes plus or minus from about 8 to 20. So, unless everyone was wrong, I figured that was pretty good odds. And I've been following, like I said, Sputnik News. I think it's appropriate for the subject matter. And they have a live feed, and it's very useful. And hopefully it's not fake news.
Sounds good. So in the last few minutes, that space station just entered. According to, I guess it was Dave that was tracking it, it was coming up over South America, heading toward Venezuela. Is that what you said during the latest tracking on Heavens Above into ACG, K2RIW? Go ahead, Dave. I should have said into APG. You got it, Dave.
Yeah, Dick, that was Paul that was tracking it, so that wasn't me. But I just learned something with regards to the new Iridium satellites. The new Iridium satellites will not be producing flare-like reflections like the old satellites. So within the next few months or so, the flares that we like to see may be disappearing. So the new satellites will not make the same old flares. And the plan is they're going to replace all the old satellites with the new satellites. So that's kind of interesting information. And 2APG.
My guess that the flat phased array was acting like a mirror and giving us a great big solar reflection. That's what the old Iridium satellites were doing. The new satellites, I'm guessing, have a new kind of an antenna that doesn't become as reflective. But the old Iridium satellites are still going to be there. Nobody has gone up there with a garbage can and collected them, even though they may not be electronically active. I don't think they have any way of removing them from space. So they're still going to be doing their... I think they're going to still be doing their exact same orbit, and therefore we're going to be getting the exact same flash from those. What do you think, Dave? N2APG, K2LIW.
All right, well, the article that I just read online says that the plan is that they will be deorbited and allowed to burn up. They will be removed from orbit. I sent you and Paul the website, the page that I just learned that from. So that's what they're saying, that the plan is they're going to be brought out of orbit and destroyed.
Wow. We've all seen the launch of those satellites. It's a great big powerful rocket that puts them into a medium Earth orbit. Not a low Earth orbit, not a high Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit, something like 10,000 miles up, which is like 9,500 miles above the atmosphere, so to speak. And in order to bring them back down, you've got to be able to do enough of a burn to get it so that the apogee of its orbit, which is a beautiful circular orbit at 10,000 miles, goes down to like a couple of hundred miles so that it hits the atmosphere. That takes a lot of thrusting. Are we sure that the Iridium satellites have enough thrusting fuel on board to do a complete deorbit burn? Is that true? Have we seen words saying that? Over to you first, Dave, and to APG, K2LAW.
Well, that's what it said on the webpage that I got that information from. Maybe Paul knows more, but apparently they have this fuel on board. For changing the, for fine-tuning and tweaking the orbit, and apparently that's what they're going to use. Whatever fuel is left, they're going to use it just to bring them down.
Yeah, after you've launched that satellite into orbit, to have enough fuel on board to do station keeping, to be more accurate as to where it's supposed to be when, that takes a very small amount of fuel, but that's a very big burn to bring it from 10,000 miles down to a couple of hundred miles. I'm amazed it got that much fuel on board. Let's see if Paul's got an opinion on this one. Do you think all of the older Iridiums, as they're being replaced, are all going to be brought back down? Do they all have enough fuel to do that? WS2N, K2IW, if you happen to have any information on that one, Paul?
Yeah, well, I know. Like, the new Iridiums, when they went up, they go up together. And the discharge from the carrier one at a time. And then they have these solar wings that come out. And the rarefied air, that you can go edge on, and they'll go faster than the ones that follow. They'll turn the satellite and have the solar panels hitting the air to slow itself down. And, by doing that, they contain this separation around the globe, but eventually it just gets larger and larger, and then they stop it by turning the satellite again edgewise into the direction that they're going. I know that's one way that they do it. Well, I don't see that they could do the same thing with the old ones and just turn them and have the rarefied air hitting them and then slowing them down over time. So I guess they could use whatever thrusters they have on board to help. But I think one of the ways they do it is actually turning the satellite so that the solar panels are going, the space part of it is going in the direction of travel. Back to you.
When you're at the altitude of the International Space Station, which is something like a... how you orient the solar panels, how much... air resistance, you guess, is certainly a big factor. When you're at the Iridium satellite altitude, which I think is 10,000 miles, I think it's a medium Earth orbit, although maybe I'm confusing that with the global positioning satellites.
Yeah, that's right, Dick.
So what's the approximate altitude of Iridium? Now it's beginning to sound more reasonable. You've got it, Paul.
I thought it was 500 or 600 kilometers. You know, 350 miles, something like that. In that area, and the same with the new ones. So, not all that high up.
Okay, if they're only 500 or 600 miles, that means they're going to need periodic boosting. I mean, the International Space Station, I think 2 or 3 times per year, we boost it back to its normal altitude because the air resistance is continuously bringing it down. That would suggest that all of the Iridium satellites at 500 or 600 miles or kilometers have a very finite life because of wind resistance bringing them down and they're burning up their own fuel to do boosting. So that sounds like the Iridiums were not built for a 20-year lifespan. What's their predicted life expectancy, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW, and the TechNet?
The new ones that went up are probably 15 years, you know, and then they hope to get 20. That's what happened with the last group that the last group. It's got to be 15, 20 years when that first group of Iridiums went up. So they've lost some of them, and they probably deorbited those a long time ago, and then they used the backup ones. So they were getting scarce, and there was a mad rush to eventually put these new ones up. And inside of, what, a year and a half, they've got almost probably 15 satellites, about 10 more to go, I think about 10 more to go. That's pretty good, you know. That's because of SpaceX bringing the cost of the flights down and being able to do them one right after the other. You know, I think last year they had 20 flights, almost 20 flights. In 1 year. So they're able to do this. And the same thing's going to happen with the internet when they start sending up all their satellites, thousands of satellites they want to put up. Okay, Dave, I got your email. I saw that. And I remember reading about this a long time ago, that the new ones probably wouldn't have a flare, but it's been a long time ago since I read that. So that kind of verifies it. Back to you there.
Paul, have we ever read any information about the how often the Iridium satellites at a 500 or 600 mile altitude, how often do they have to be boosted because of wind resistance bringing them down? Or is that something that takes place on an almost continuous basis with the station-keeping jets that are on board? So,
Repeater, timeout.
Sounds to me like a couple of times per year, at least, they will need some boosting. Have they ever said that to your knowledge, Paul? Go ahead.
I believe they're the ones, I'll have to check, they're the ones, I think, that use the gravitational anomaly over the Atlantic. Because of the way their time, when they get there, they start accelerating, and that keeps them... it's like a free ride for these things. I'm pretty sure it was the Iridium satellites that do that. They call it the Atlantic anomaly, or I forget the name. There's a gravitational disturbance in the Atlantic, and if you time your satellites just right, you can use that to accelerate your satellites in space.
Yeah, there was a number of articles about satellite flybys. When you do planetary boost, when you put a satellite in space and you fly it near another planet, depending on whether you cross the planet nearby on the right side or the left side, you can get a boost or a buck to your velocity. And if you're going to do any burn of the rocket engine, during the time you're closest to the satellite, when you're at the perigee, so to speak, and you're at the highest velocity, any boosting you do at that time gives you extra benefit. So I guess with the Earth's South Atlantic anomaly, a mass concentration, when the satellite is at a higher velocity, lower altitude, and if you're going to do any station keeping, that's the time to do it because you get the biggest bang for the buck, so to speak. The fuel you carry on board could be considered cargo, and so the faster that cargo is moving, the more benefit you're getting out of the thrust you use at that time. So if you're going to do a burn, do it at perigee if you possibly have that option. The next person on the list that signed in with a question or a comment was Joe, the B2RYY. The B2RYY, you've got it, Joe. K2RYW, the TechNet. Maybe Joe got called away. We'll go to Jay now and then come back to Joe. Kilo Delta 2, Papa Kilo Alpha. You've got it, Jay. K2IW in the TechNet.
I was just wondering when that satellite was going to come down, but I guess that was all answered. Thank you.
Okay, going down the list of people who checked in except for Joe, and he can check in anytime when he hears my voice and he's available to come back. Last week, Bob, Katie 2, November Victor Bravo, was talking about antennas he's going to use inside of his third floor apartment, and Bill AC2IS was also asking me questions about loop antennas, and I was making a prediction that a loop antenna where the plane of the loop was made parallel to the earth would give you the best nevus aberration, near vertical incident sky wave, and I was dead wrong. Turns out that I think only a couple percent of the amateurs have ever used a loop antenna, and there's no good reason for that sparseness, because loop antennas, although they're physically small, can give you very high performance. In the early days of AM radios on automobiles, you had a whip antenna on the radio because the AM radio runs in the vicinity of one megacycle, where the wavelength is 300 meters. Almost 1,000 feet is the wavelength. That little whip antenna is so infinitesimally small in wavelength, it operates at an extremely high impedance, that whip antenna, on the AM radios of, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago. If you put your finger anywhere on that whip antenna and you're listening to the car radio went dead because of the loading of your finger. That antenna was running at a 5,000 ohm impedance. Let me drop it. And you can imagine on the early transistorized portable radios, to put a whip antenna on there would be very difficult. So for compact transistorized AM radios, they developed something called the loop antenna, the ferrite loop antenna. Because that piece of ferrite probably has a mu of close to 1,000, that means the magnetic field flows through that rod 1,000 times better than it does through air. So every radio wave consists of a magnetic field and an electrostatic field. And so the loop antenna favors the magnetic field. The magnetic field goes through that rod. The wire wrapped around the rod picks up that signal, and you're resonating that wire that's wrapped around it. So the ferrite rod inside of an AM portable transistorized radio is an extremely effective antenna. And so we amateurs, we don't use the ferrite rod, because when you're operating at, say, 21 megacycles, let me drop this. As you go to higher frequencies, the ferrite materials, the particles, have to be made smaller and smaller, so you're not getting eddy current effects and skin effects. And each of the individual particles have to be insulated from each other. So the process of producing the ferrite for higher HF and VHF frequencies becomes more and more difficult, and you end up with smaller particles, greater separation, lower mu of the material, lower magnetic field concentration capability. So ferrite rods for receiving antennas have occasionally been used at amateur frequencies. For transmitting, you'd have problems of saturating that rod. But many amateurs don't use loop antennas. So therefore, because of their unpopularity, we don't learn of their characteristics. If you did do what I was suggesting last week, take the plane of the loop antenna and lay it parallel to the earth. That means the equivalent magnetic field, as if you were putting the rod through the middle of it, would be right down the axis of the antenna. So when the plane of the antenna is parallel to the earth, the theoretical magnetic rod would be perpendicular to the earth, which is the equivalent of making a dipole vertical. If I made a dipole vertically polarized, every dipole off the ends has a null in its performance. Well, a loop antenna laid parallel to the earth would have a null in its performance straight up and straight down. It would not give you a good excitation of a near vertical incident sky wave signal. So I was dead wrong on that one. Parallel to the earth, you would be emitting a horizontally, let me drop it. You would be emitting a horizontally polarized signal at all azimuths.